is to hear Leonard give his experience, Picks of Hope, and I'd like to welcome Leonard to the podium.
You guys are recording this. So my name is Leonard, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you would, take a moment of silence to ask for guidance and direction. And please help Leonard. Okay. So there's this guy, he's doing this, trying to walk into a bar. And there's a sign on the bar that says, free beer forever if you can pass the test. So of course, because of what's the test. He said, you see that bottle, that gallon bottle of pepper tequila? You have to drink the whole thing and not even make a face. Then he said, well, alligator out back, of course, this is in Florida. And you got to take them little tires, you have to go out there and pull a tooth out from that alligator. And then there's a lady upstairs that's never had an orgasm. You got to give her one. The guy's like, dude, you're crazy. Just give me a, I'll pay for the beer. He drinks about 3-4 beers. He goes, give me that bottle of tequila. And sure enough, he takes it and guzzles it down, throws it back in front of him. He says, give me those pliers. So he goes back outside. After a while, he comes back, he's all ripped up and stuff like that. And then he goes, all right, where's that lady who I need to take the tooth out of? Hey, can you get one on? So being convinced we're at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives were good. Most people like to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. It's forever trying to arrange the ballet, the lights, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangers can only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actors may be sometimes quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modestly self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have various traits. So the reason why I like to share that is because my whole life was from one extreme to the other. Nicest, most charming guy that you could ever imagine. And then the flip side is a monster that if you saw me coming down the street, you would cross the street. You would literally go on the other side of the street. And that was my alcoholism. So I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it was like now. One of the things I've come to realize about alcoholism is that, yeah, that the circumstances were different, but the feelings were always the same. As long as I can remember, I always felt like there was something not quite right, either inside of me or with the rest of the world. I really believe that everyone else on the planet had a secret and they just weren't telling me. Because everyone else seemed to be just going, moving along fine and everything seemed to work out for them. But it never seemed to work out for me. I was born to a drill sergeant. My dad was a senior staff sergeant flipping. And he was a rageaholic. My dad could scare the shit out of anybody with some 50 feet. He could yell and hit the pin on the small field. He put the fear of God in me. This is going to sound kind of gross for anything. But by the time I was 7 years old, my asshole was shut this height from the foot. You know what I mean? To this day, I hate Sunday mornings because my dad was home. And I have to walk around. And I started to realize that he actually got pleasure out of scaring the shit out of him. But I was lucky because I'm the only boy with three sisters. I have two sisters older than me and one younger than me. And they got it a lot worse. What happened to my family, there was two camps. There was my mom and my sisters, and there was me and my dad. My only chore in the whole world was just to take out the garbage after dinner. And I remember one of the first assholes that worst I ever got was because it was dark, and we had this big, long hallway where we had to go all the way out to the other end of it. So I took the garbage, and I just put it down at the end of the steps. Well, some asshole came out and kicked the garbage, and they kicked it all the way down the hallway. So it's a building with a bunch of other people. My dad is like the senior ranking person. So sure enough, someone said, somebody left garbage all over the thing. And I was in my bed. And my dad came in and pulled me out of that bed and just tore into me like nobody's business. So that's what life was kind of like for me. Even at that point, I didn't feel right. But I didn't know what the problem was. At the time, we lived in Germany. So here I am, this black boy, little black kid, I don't know, I must have been 9 or 10 years old, in this world that's basically blue, he was in the Air Force, in this foreign country. I was in heaven. And there was woods and trees, it was like I had the most wonderful childhood on the outside. But on the inside, I was scared, I was alone, and I was alienated. Because you got to remember, I had 3 sisters, and they had their side of the world, and it was me and my dad, and they resented me, they resented the shit out of me. We would have Christmases, and one half of the tree would be theirs, and the entire other half of the tree would be mine. Because my dad was just an ass like that. The irony of it was that every one of those toys was a toy he wanted me to have, not what I wanted. So I grew up with this idea of not feeling like I wasn't worthy of what I wanted. My job was to figure out what you wanted. And I sharpened that skill really well. The other thing I learned how to do was to work with my mom and my sister. And so when I was 11, 12, my parents were split up. And my dad came here to California, and let me get back to another thing, and we moved to Atlanta, Georgia. So I don't know if you knew about it. Anybody here ever lived in Atlanta, Georgia? Yeah, so you know the demographics? Yeah, there's black people, and there's white people, and there's separation about too big, right? And the white people, they live pretty good. Black people are poor. I'm talking dirt poor. I had never been hungry in my life until we moved to Atlanta, Georgia. Being the only boy or the only man in the house, I had this sense of responsibility. So I'm a pretty smart cook and I'm a really fast learner. So I very quickly acclimated to the circumstances and I became a criminal. I became a gang member. I became a grifter. And I became a pimp. Because I realized that the only way for me to survive was to figure out how to get something from other people that I wanted by giving as little as I possibly could. Just like this book was talking about. And I learned to be the most sweet, nice, loving, caring person you could ever imagine. Or on the other side, from my dad, a monster that will make you piss in your pants. And that became my mode of operation in order to survive. And honestly, I think that I would have probably been a pretty good pimp.
Yeah.
I like to believe that. Or I would probably been a pretty good route of a gangster or whatever. One small problem. Alcohol. From the very beginning, alcohol just devastated me. None of that stuff makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what it is. I remember when I was like 6 or 7, my first drink, my first drunk. So my parents, of course, they partied. They were alcoholics, and they partied. And I remember each of them was big, I think it was half a gallon, and they were sitting in this little tumbler thing where you could just, it's like a rotator. And then they had like ice. They loved ice back then. I don't know what the hell it was about, but everyone had ice buckets. And they had these little plastic cups. And everyone was partying, and they were putting little drinks in the nice cups. And they were, and eventually just moved all these little cups around. So I'm doing, I'm not this big, so I'm running around and I'm drinking the leftovers of their cups. The next thing I remember, my whole family was surrounding me, and I'm laying on my back, covered in cheese, in their black hands. That was my first blackout. Looking back, I could have died. And I should have known something was wrong. But I had no clue. And the irony of it was that alcohol wasn't my first drug. That wasn't the first thing. My first drug was the thrill of keep taking advantage of people. I call it the criminal mentality. And for those of you that don't really understand that, it works like this. There's us, and then there's them. And then I have this idea that if you're one of us, we're cool, we work together. If you're one of them, I have the right to do anything I want to do to get whatever I need. So if it's stealing, robbing, lying, cheating, whatever, it's that criminal mentality, and it's justified. That became my first drug. It took me a long time to come to those terms. So before I ever started doing things because of alcoholism, I already had that tendency inside of me to lie, to cheat, to steal. These come, Leonard's a badass little boy, you know. I remember I was thinking about this the other day, so my mom took me to a babysitter, right? I don't remember how old I was, but she was this. So I kissed in her bed. I mean, just that, you know. They tried to send me to Sunday school. And I don't remember what I said, but I stood up in front of the entire congregation, and it was something like, you know, how do you know Jesus is right? I mean, something like, oh, fucked up. That's the way it happened. Don't ever send me here again. You know, and it was just stuff like that that I came up with. It was just part of my personality, you know, and just bad. And it wasn't mean. Well, it was mean, but I wasn't coming from a mean place. It was just something in me that just, that's how I did life, you know. But then the flip side, the people, oh, I love Leonard, I knew exactly what I needed to say to get you to do what I wanted to do. I became really good at that. So, of course, you know, so eventually I got ran out of Atlanta. We robbed this some drug dealer's house, some big kind of guy, and the dude told me, you get him out of here, we're going to kill him. Period. That's it. We know it was him. And so my mom put me on an airplane and sent me to sunny California. And as soon as I got off that plane, I knew it was on. There was lots of white people. And I had grown up in that environment. So and then there was palm trees and burritos. I had never seen a burrito before. I never seen that. And the school was outside. Yeah. You know, these folks' schools are this big, jungle building, and it's locked in, and they close the doors, the chains on the doors. So I was in heaven for about a week. And I don't know how this happened, but all of a sudden, I found myself in the carport across the street from the high school, slamming heroin with a bunch of VLPs. My alcoholism and my addiction just progressed. It took on a life of its own. I had completely no power over it. I thought I did, but I didn't. So I remember the period where I don't know, they made that movie about NWA. What was the name of that movie? Straight Out of Compton. I don't remember what it was. So I grew up, that was my era. That's when I grew up. But that didn't quite happen yet. So then I did that. Of course, I you know, being the new guy in town, and being who I was, I met, you know, the prettiest girl in school, very quickly got her pregnant, got kicked out of school for, I forgot what it was, over marijuana, because I started smoking marijuana, and I had to have it with me everywhere I went. And of course they caught me, so my dad, I remember he came to Santa Maria, and my dad, because he had a little bit of rank, back then they used to take you, and if you got drunk, they would actually take you home and say, here's your kid, you know, take care of him. So I remember I went in front of the judge and he said, okay, you have a choice. Either go to Los Ritos Boys Camp or sign a waiver and join the Army. I was 17 years old. So I'm saying, cool, I'll sign the waiver. My dad's like, and you're getting married. I'm like, where is he? Whoa, hey, wait. Obviously that was not part of the deal, but of course it was my dad. I'm sorry to say that I do not remember one moment of my marriage. They showed me pictures. I mean, the whole thing, I don't remember one moment. I was in complete blackout. I remember coming to the next day in my bed at home thinking, what am I doing here? Tuxedo all screwed up. And that's what my life was like. You know, many days I would wake up and think, oh my God, what did I do last night? What did I do last night? And I know a lot of us have that guilt and that shame, that remorse, and that idea of not being able to do anything better. So, So they put us on a bus and said, I'll never forget this. So we join the military, and what they do is they sign you up, and then they get you to L.A., and then when you get to L.A., they put you on a bus. And they put you on the bus, and they tell you on the bus, you got some cancer. You got any drugs or anything on you, put them in your can. Now, Leonard, and sure enough, I get there, they find these drugs on me, and I ride up the down patrol. Right off the bat, my military career is in trouble. Although, I'm a good, smart cookie, right? So I can manipulate my way through that. I was Fort Bliss, Texas. We would literally jump over the, I didn't do it, but I had a friend of mine who would jump, climb over the barbed wire, go into, I don't know if he went to Mexico or whatever, and we would come back with Everclear. Alcoholics. We believe that if you were drinking Everclear, nobody could smell it. No figure. And that's what we did. I mean, come on. I mean, basic training. We're like 5 miles a day. We're supposed to drink Everclear at night. That was, you know. And so, you know, that was just what I did. We just, that was the thing. And so I barely made it through. As a matter of fact, I'm really smart. And I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm not too smart for my own good. I actually was a valedictorian of my class. But they took it from me because I got in a fight downtown the night before graduation and laced some guy in the face with him. So they took it from me because of that. And that's what I did. It's what I call the Sabotage Syndrome. You're right to the finish line, and then I kicked the whole bucket over. So then I went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That was my duty station. With my wife and my new son, and very promptly got a 70 again. So here I am, first time away from home, got a paycheck coming in, and I have freedom. And I'm in the Army, and we drink less fish. And I'm in what they call the combat battalion. That means we're in the field all the time after the Korean War. And I remember going to one of my sergeants and saying, you know, what about my family? He said, we didn't issue you a family. And so it was really hard. You know, being in the military is really hard. Being a parent is really hard. You know, it's really difficult, especially when you don't have anyone to show you how to do it. My solution was to drink. And when I drank, I got violent. And that's exactly what happened there. You know, I very quickly started drinking. We got into this confrontation between the East Coast and West Coast. It didn't really matter. I hurt a guy really, really bad. The pressure got on. Eventually, I had to send her home. And then I actually went and asked for an other than honorable discharge, just so I could get out of that situation. Again, the alcoholic that I am, I expect her to wait for me. And I came back to the law folks, and she had met some other guy, and I was devastated. And I just went on a run. Shortly after that, cocaine started falling out of the sky. Literally falling out of the sky. I'm not going to go into details about that, but what I can tell you is I made a whole lot of money. I spent a whole lot of money, and I'm not proud of this. And I got a whole lot of people addicted on that drug. A whole lot of people. I literally destroyed our community. I didn't care who you were. If I could make eyes on Facebook contact with you, I would take a pipe and I would go be a friend and watch you turn into an animal and laugh about it. Part of the reason why I do what I do today is trying to make amends the best that I can for the devastation that caused our world, our society. I very quickly became a convict, started going to prison, loved prison. I love prison. And here's why. Because when I went to prison, I stopped using drugs and I could focus. And I started rebotting, you know, I did the whole thing. Started working out. Back then we were bodybuilders, so you know, I was really getting buff and doing that thing. I do my whole thing, get swole, we call it getting swole. Right? And then come back out here and act like a maniac. Yeah. And I did that for years. In and out, 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 in and out. You know, I decided, so there's those two kids, they told me, they said, this kid was still a stranger. I just think about him every day. They told me, they said, Dad, we know more about you from the street than we know in person. Mm-hmm. My oldest son, Leonard, He was shot by the Lompoc police right after his 18th birthday. So that rage was building up in me. I was raging. And I liked it. I said it. I can remember, if I wanted to do something to someone, I would start drinking and I would start thinking about it. And I would just get that rage up. And sometimes I'd be in a blackout, but I knew that I was going to do something that if it didn't hurt him, it was going to scare the shit out of him enough to where it hurt him. And I can remember very clearly thinking, this is how I'm going to get through life. So it's needless to say I had a problem with the police. A serious problem with the police. Very serious. They would harass me every chance they got. So much so, and I'll share this because, so much so that I remember at the height of it, I climbed up on the top of the Lompoc High School with 22 rifles, and I was standing there waiting for a Lompoc police officer to drive by. The only thing that saved me is my lighter ran out of fuel. I couldn't get out anymore. I'm like, fuck it, I'm gonna stand there pressing their money. that rage was just so, and I didn't know. I had no idea. I had no idea that I was in that much rage. I came to my first AA meeting, like right after my dad's taking this. I was to my first AA meeting when I was still in high school. Freedom Group, the Long Group. And I feel Poppy came in and left. What did I talk to? Went to NA, very quickly after that. Kind of did the thing. But I came back, that cocaine thing wouldn't trip me to my knees. So I think that lasted about 4 or 5 years. And finally, I was like, I got to do something about this. And I'll never forget it. So we talked about that. We talked about surrender. So you know that in NA, they got these little key tags, right? That's a little key tag?
Yeah.
So I could not stay clean. So if you're one of those people that could not stay clean, don't feel bad. All right? You ain't got nothing on me. I went in and out here for a long time. But one of the nervous happened for me was like, I could not stay clean. I could not get 30 days. So finally, I took a newcomer chip and I took a quarter and I pasted it on there. And I carried that newcomer chip and I said, before I get high, let's get this in the phone book. Let's only have phone books. And call somebody. Right? And I stayed. I didn't drink and I didn't get unloaded long enough for this special to go away. And to me, that was like, it was a miracle. I'll never forget that. I was like, wow. I kept that quarter in that thing for years. So that was the first miracle for me. I was like, this thing can really stop me from using, from drinking. I know it's alcohol, so I'm listening. So that was the first miracle for me. I knew that this thing would stop me from drinking. It would stop me from using. And so I was still full of all of that stuff. So I would use the room as a way of cleaning up my act and staying out of jail long enough to get enough stuff together so I could go out and do it again. And I was always about exploiting people. I didn't know how to not exploit people. So I couldn't keep a job. I didn't know how to have a job. I didn't know how to do a fair trade. I just didn't know how to do it. So I would always exploit people. I'd always say, I'm in sales. I'm in the sales business. You know what I mean? And so I was coming here with those kind of morals and kind of values. And I didn't know that I couldn't, I was hurting people when I was doing that. But I just didn't know any other way to do it. So I would come in, start feeling better. People would start kind of looking at me sideways like, what are you really doing here? And then, of course, I would go back out. I'd come in, and I'd go out. Finally, I met a girl in here. Probably one of the most attractive women I've ever met in general. In the world. Also one of the most crazy. I'm talking doing like, but that's what I like. I like that. I like cray cray. You know what I mean? I like cray cray too. But the problem is when you're trying to raise a family and you're trying to stay sober, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. But I was determined that this was going to be the one. I'm done. And I was heartbroken over my first 2 kids. So I've been married 3 times. In my middle one, I had a son. But she was my penitentiary wife. She put money on my books, whatever I got, you kind of get business, she was a thoroughbred, she ran. But as soon as I decided to turn my life around, I didn't need her, and I owe her this for that because, to this day she's still heartbroken that I left her to this NA family I'm gonna treat. Anyway, I keep thinking that one. And I was determined that this was going to be the one that was going to fix me. I'm going to love you. I can't fix you. And that's when I got serious. But I wasn't able to do it because I wasn't able to surrender. And I still had that game inside of me. We made regardless of our alcohol, and that was wanted, and my life had become manageable. And I still thought I could manage my life because I'm so freaking smart. So I used this program as a way of trying to manage my deviant behavior or my alternative ways of living. And it took me a while to figure that out. No, it didn't. I still didn't figure it out. I'm lying. Here's what happened. So I manipulated that for a while. And then life got really good. I was able to put some cruise time under my belt. I got started a business, an actual legitimate sales business that really made good money. I had cool people working under with me. I sold my dad's house in Longport. We went to Arizona, bought another house. We had a rental. And then I decided to try to put that up at me. It was a nightmare. I lost everything. And my dad passed away. I literally lost everything. My dad and my sisters had been estranged for like forever. Since my dad and my mother Philip had not spoken to each other. So you can imagine what they did when they found out dad was dead. They came in like vultures. And I was in prison at the time. It was nothing I could do. So I walked out of prison, I think a couple of days after Christmas. And in 2016, I had a year already under my belt. And I got off the bus station over here. I forget was that, I don't remember, by the 1500 Club. And I walked into a sober living, and when I walked into the sober living, there was a bunch of essays in there. And they were smoking meth. And I forgot to tell you this part. So previous to me going to that, I was in going to prison. I had been in the worst riot in the history of LA County Jail. It was between black and Mexican. It was the worst. I mean, we were locked up for 31 days. I fought for like 10 days straight. Talk about traumatized, particularly with Mexican men. This is kind of high power work. And so I'm already pissed off at my higher power, you feel me? But I'm trying to work this program. And I walk in here, I see a room full of Mexican men smoking meth. I'm like, all right, God, what the fuck? I need a break. Seriously. And I break, I told him, I said, man, you know, Spencer, I'm trying to work the program. And they were like, okay, cool, no problem. And I didn't have any of my clothes on. I didn't have any of my clothes on. Because when you get out of LA, you don't have no clothes. I had a shirt on, I was too tight. Some pants, somebody else, some underwear, some shoes. I mean, I was a mess. And it was raining. So I asked one of the guys, he made me kind of jacket to give me those little army jackets. And I walked from there over to the Alana Club. And I started crying. And I walked in and I sat down. Because it was a noon meeting. And in the middle of the meeting, I stood and I raised my head. I said, you know what? My name's Leonard. And you motherfuckers told me you would help me, now fucking help me. And they did. And I hung out that round club every day. Bitch, you became the manager of it. In the midst of that, I became a manager of a sober living. I was done. I was broken. And I was pissed off at God. Oh, was I angry at God. But being angry at God and willing to do the right, the next thing, that next fucking thing, have nothing to do with each other. If you're sitting here right now and you got a problem with God, that's fine. We're not asking you to be friends with God. We're just asking you to accept that there is one and you have the ability to do the next right thing. The rest is kind of magical. I don't even know how else to say it. It was like magic. Because I was that broken and I was that broken, I was willing to do what you told me to do. All of a sudden, all the things that I didn't want to do before, I was willing to do. I stayed out of intimate relationships. I stayed celibate for my first 2 years. I have lots of girlfriends now. I couldn't let that go. But that was okay. We had a relationship. And to this day, I have wonderful relationships with women because I was able to do that. And then that changed. I was able to get a job. Ready? So I got lots of kids, and I got freaking child support. If you're in here now and you got problems with child support, I pity the fool. I worked for minimum wage, and they took half of everything I made for, God, years, months, years. We would go, I had to have men's meeting, right? And every man's name, I grab and cry about.
Fuck the child support.
But you know, I worked through it. I worked through it. And that taught me. That taught me that it works for to work for work and not for the profit, not for the money. And it taught me how to depend on my higher power, however it came to me. It taught me financial security. There is not enough money on this planet to make me feel financially secure. It's impossible. The only security that I have is in my higher power. And I know that no matter what, me and my higher power is going to get through it. Homeless or not, rich or not, poor or not, I'm going to be okay. So when money problems come up, let's not do it. And I had that sense of freedom there. I remember I was sitting in the meeting on Hall of Commons. And I remember, it was in here, and I remember, and I looked over and I said, you know what? I can survive any feeling I ever have. I reached a point where I realized that I didn't have to run from any of these feelings anymore. I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but that was huge for me. Because I was one of those people that if I had a feeling, I had to do something about it. And if you were excited to do that feeling, you better watch out. Good or bad. If you're hot and you're still all good and shit, watch out. But that was a huge freedom for me today. Another reason why I share that is because a lot of the people that I work with, I realize that we have, you know, do this, but I realize that it's kind of we have this stuff going on, I don't know that I can survive it. I got to do something about it. And I think that that was the beginning of me for some of the maturity in my program. You know, I was able to do things that I didn't want to, you know, to be more responsible. Oh, that's another word, doesn't it? I hated the word responsibility. It literally, the word responsibility literally gave me chills. And it was like that for years. I can even remember going, you know, getting older and saying, fuck, man. I got, one day I got to, you know, grow up. Because, you know, so if you're under the age of 25, I love saying this. There's going to come a day where you're going to go, fuck, maybe I should grow up. And then you're going to go, how the fuck did I do that? And then if you have a listener, you're going to pick up your mom, you'll pick up the phone and call your mom and dad, and you're going to be like, you know, I just want to tell you you were right. And then you're going to be that long pause, right? Because you expect them to give you this big old thing of wisdom, and they're going to be like, okay. No help here? And so I had that, and I remember very clearly thinking, I don't care how much it's time to grow up, you do not have the capacity to be responsible. It's not in you. And I don't feel like that today. I don't feel like I cannot. Well, here's the truth of the matter. It's because I'm not the one doing it. It's my higher power. If I can't, we can do it. I can't do it. Tough shit. Right? It's my higher power. I just suit up and show up. What else do I want to show about that? Oh, let's talk about resentment. So something else that happened in that early part of my recovery was that absolutely no saved my life. There was a man named Jack B. called Ponytail Jack. And I was so bad that a probation officer literally took me down to a restaurant, and back there, a Caesar's restaurant, took me in and said, you see that guy over there? That Jack, I want you to go ask him to be responsible. This is a probation officer. This is how bad I am. And so I looked at Jack and he was really kind of trying to do it. And, okay, then you know, it's a really tough spoken. And so he became our first sponsor in the middle of the program. And Jack took me through the first few steps, but he didn't stop there. He took me through the fourth step. Now, previous to this, I have to tell the story. So, previous to this, I had tried the steps. I did it in prison. Here's what I did in prison. I went to prison and I got off the bus, right? And I got off the bus and there's all these Crips. Right? And there's all these Bloods. And I'm thinking, this is a war zone. And I'm thinking, I ain't no Blood. I'm a Crip. I was part of starting the original Crips and Lawful. I was helped start the Crips and Lawful. I got news for you. The Crips and Lawful ain't shit like the Crips and Crips. Yeah, they're doing like two girls with each other, right?
So I'm in there, I'm looking like, what the fuck am I going to do now? And I see this old black guy walking like this. And I'm like, hey, what are you doing? And he says, I'm a lifer. And I come down these points, and I come down so far, they let me on this two-yard, and I get in the two-yard, and we have this club called the Road Siders. And the Road Siders are a bunch of guys who do alcohol slums. So I'm looking at the bus, because he knows where he's been there. And so I became part of the Road Siders. And it saved me. Because I was at that age where not only was I intelligent, but I was also someone that was expected to put in work. And I mean real work. And if you didn't put in work, they would put work in on me. And this book saved me. Well, while I was there, I did a force share. It was more like an autobiography, but it was a force share. And so when I got out, I remember I went to a halfway house in Toledo, and there was this guy who used to come up and drive the van. I kept up in the house truck, and I was right now. Even to this day, I love men, but men are not my favorite people. Never have been. I like women. I like women a lot. But I'm a man, and I need to be learning how to connect with men, and I'm learning how to do that, and I do that today. I'm working with a lot of men. So this guy's coming by, and he's the most humble guy you could ever see. And I couldn't figure out, why is this guy doing this? He would come by 3 days a week, and most of the time, we'd be like, man, you don't want to go to another AA meeting. And sure enough, he's there the next day, next week. And so I started going, and I thought, that's the guy I want to read this force there to, because he was so humble that it was like, just like mind-boggling. I couldn't believe it, someone was humble. So he took me out to the beach, and he did this little ceremony, and I read it to him and shit, and he took a little fire, and told me the story about the phoenix, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'm thinking, oh, this is bullshit. But I did that process. And then, of course, I disappeared when he got loaded again. The man was doing most. This guy was brilliant from his fellowship. So in between that, I went and did this other four-step, and he took me through those steps, and he took me through a four-step to what a four-step was supposed to be done. And that's when I realized that I hated everybody, and I hated everything. And I realized that I had a rage inside of me, that if I didn't do something about it, I was going to kill myself or somebody else, or seriously damage them. That man took me through that step, and it saved my life. If you're new and you have not worked through those first four or five steps, please do yourself a break and work these steps. These steps are nothing more than spiritual principles that we learn how to apply in our lives. And they work every single time. Just give yourself a break and try. So fast forward, this last time I did everything. I go to prison, and guess what I do in prison? Write another four step. So now I'm sitting on a four step. Now, by this time I've ventured away from the 1600 club. I come over here to the law club, I come over to the 1600 club. And if anybody knows that I'm always in the corner, always got my back in the corner, I got the seat up. So you can't, it's a barrier thing. I need to know where everybody's at and how I get away. So I'm sitting over that corner, whatever way is that. And I'm thinking, I need a sponsor. And I'm not really, I mean, I can talk real good, but I don't really like asking for help. I don't know about you, anybody here like asking for help?
No.
No, that shit sucks. Bad. Like to the point where I'm like, I finally feel like I broke it. No, just text it. You get over to you. And sure enough, exactly like what it happened before, Billy walked through the door. He walked through the door. And he took me to his steps. Billy didn't just take me to his steps. Billy loved me when I felt completely unlovable. She gave me a job. She stood by me. She gave me rides. She bought me clothes. She bought me a bike. And he stood by me and he helped me to get back on my feet. He helped me to reintegrate back into society. And it was a very humbling process. It was a very humbling. All of it was humbling. Very humbling. And that was what I needed. That was what I needed. So... my higher power has done for me what I could not do for myself at every step of the way. But I had to do what I had to do. And that was the hard part. But I found that my higher power does not put very big expectations on me. He doesn't put things, or she doesn't, or it, whatever, doesn't put things on me that I can't handle. And if I'm willing and honest and open-minded, everything's going to be okay. And that's the cool part about it. Here's the not so cool part about it. I don't get to choose who I'm going to become. I don't get to pick who the people are going to be in my life. I don't even get to choose the flavor of my birthday cake. And here's why. If I come to God, my higher power has a plan for me that's way better than anything I can come up with. And the plans up here are sick. I'm still sick. If I still had it my way, I'd be riding around in a Cadillac. You know what I'm saying? With a little group, with a little entourage, you know. I don't have to work, of course. You know, that ain't happening. Because everybody knows. No problems for anybody. And that's my life. But I still have this thing up here that tells me that. And every now and then I start listening to it, it sounds like a good idea. Yeah, maybe I could get just a little bit closer to that. And now I'm in trouble. Because now I'm looking for something outside of me one more time to sit down something on the inside. This disease is a threefold disease. 8 o'clock, right? So the nature of this disease is threefold. Right? It's a mental obsession with a physical compulsion, all fueled by spiritual void. Again, it's like a cake. And then you sprinkle a little denial on top of there, and it's a wrap. I'm beyond human aid. I am beyond human aid. I will rapidly justify myself right into the grave. And that's where I need something greater than myself to come in and take care of me. So the solution is the reverse. It's the very reverse. If I just work on this part of the spiritual void, if I'm willing to work along the spiritual mind, and that spiritual void is addressed, then the compulsion and the obsession don't have the power they have over me because I don't start acting on it. The obsession is just a thought. I can think all day. I can think the most horrendous stuff in the world. As long as I don't act on it, I'm fine. Yeah. That's the miracle of this disease. And the minute I act on it, I'm going to start that compulsion. And I'm going to keep doing it until I'm done. And that's when I need to ask for help. Please come sit on me until this compulsion goes away. Please. And so what happens is the time between those bouts of self-will, we have a word for that, you guys, just so you know. It's called self-will. Run riot. So the bouts between them get less and less and less, I mean, more, and the time I stay in them get less. And what it's replaced with is peace and serenity. This weekend, I was in three Native American ceremonies, back to back to back to back. Since Friday at about 3-4 o'clock. So I've been in ceremony. So I've been in a ceremony we call it living in the world. So I live in the world of grace and peace and love, that spiritual world, while walking around in the spiritual body. And I get to do all of that, then I get to come here, and I get to share this with you from the fullness of my heart. As clear of a message that I possibly can. Because you people and this program have given me the ability to do that. None of this is mine. All this is mine. Here's my strength and my hope. I can't claim any of it. It's just what has happened for me.
I'm almost done. I really want to tell you happy birthday, April. I love you. We've done this before. Keep coming back. Mark, I love you, and I'm so grateful that you brought your wife here with you. And what a wonderful day this is. And I know, because I've been able to watch you grow. And what a gift. What a gift. Dale, where's Dale at? I love you. Jason? Where's Jason at? Jason, I love you. What's up, homie? Yeah, I love you, man. And Wendy? Hi, I'll get you off the meeting. You guys like that, huh? Oh, yeah.
I just try not to practice it.
If no one's told you today, I want you to know that I love you. And you may say, Leonard, you don't know me. Oh, yes, I do. I know the pain. I know the grief. I know the loneliness. I know the despair. I've known the horrendous darkness that just means those to us. And it's the same. And I also know how much courage it takes to come sit in this room for an hour and listen to someone like me talk on the side of my neck. That takes courage. It takes an honesty. It takes an open-mindedness. And it takes a willingness. That is beyond human comprehension. If you ain't an alcoholic, you ain't gonna get it. But I get it. And I love you for that. Thank you.
Let's give Leonard another round, huh?